Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are much important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much in the way you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for that disclaimer. We appreciate you very much. Tonight's discussion is regarding the rules, federal rules of civil procedure, with specificity to Rule 12b-6. 12b-6 is one of the responses to a plea. Federal rules of civil procedure, Rule 12b-6 pertains to pretrial motions, and the 12b-6 specifically deals with motions to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. We've heard that before. As a practical matter, Rule 12b-6 motions are rarely successful. And when they are, their success usually has more to do with the judge than the law, which gives us great latitude in leveraging a challenge to a 12b-6 motion. Nevertheless, they appear regularly in law school civil procedure exams and as well as bar exam civil procedure questions. So it's important to be aware of them. Quote, failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, end quote, can mean a number of things, all of which have to do with what is stated in the complaint. First and most typically, this means that the complaint failed to properly allege one or more of the required elements of an action. And here's what's meant by this. Suppose someone files a complaint for negligence, and in that complaint, the plaintiff must allege all of the elements of negligence, and the elements must be applied to the defendant or defendants. For example, in this hypothetical negligent lawsuit, let's say that the defendant hit the plaintiff with his car. The plaintiff would have to allege all of the elements of negligence and apply them to the defendant, such as the following. One, the defendant owed to plaintiff a duty of care. Two, defendant breached that duty of care. Three, plaintiff suffered injuries. And four, the injuries were the result of the defendant's breach of duty. As mentioned earlier, 12b-6 motions are rarely successful, in no small part because pleading requirements are generally quite liberal. In spite of these lax requirements, however, the pleading example just given would be insufficient to defeat a 12b-6 motion. The pleading is insufficient because all it does in court parlance is merely recite bare legal conclusions. The complaint must do so with much more than this. Specifically, a factual basis for the claim must be established by the complaint. Using the same example, the complaint must be also include details on how the defendant was negligent and how the negligence caused the plaintiff's injuries. Perhaps the defendant ran a red light and collided with the plaintiff's vehicle or the plaintiff itself. Perhaps the conclusion, the collision, caused the plaintiff to break a leg or worse. Complaints must contain factual allegations such as these to be considered as having, quote, stated a claim upon which relief could be granted, end quote. Further, the more factual detail that can be included in the complaint, the better. One reason for this is to ensure that you have sufficiently pled the elements of the cause of action listed in your complaint. Another reason, and an important one at that, is the standard that is used to review 12b6 motions. Specifically, when deciding such a motion, the court assumes all factual allegations contained in the complaint to be true, giving the plaintiff the full benefit of the doubt. Recognizing this, it is vital to include every fact that could in any way be relevant to give the court as complete a picture as possible. Even if you have perfectly pled the elements of a given cause of action and included a complete and detailed set of facts, Rule 12b6 motion could succeed nonetheless, although less commonly, the reason for such success of such a motion, the court could decide that the pleaded cause of action isn't recognized by the law. Using the example mentioned earlier of the car accident, if the plaintiff claimed assault and battery instead of negligence, by all the facts remain the same, well, the car accident truly was an accident and there was no intent to cause injury to the plaintiff. Well, in that case, the 12b6 motion, at least in regards to the assault and battery claims, would succeed. Particularly, or practically speaking, the judge would usually give the plaintiff leave to amend if a legal cause of action was apparent from the facts, but the 12b6 motion would still technically be successful. In any legal case, it's important to make certain that the facts alleged in the complaint are well supported and accurate, and save yourself, you know, the time and find mistakes before they happen with more efficient legal research tools. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And we have Brother John here now, so I hope that I've laid the foundation for him. And let's turn the call over to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Good evening. Thank you, Michael. Establishing standing is of critically prime importance. When you the three biggest reasons pleading is not recognized or is overruled or dismissed are the first one, lack of standing, meaning that you are or are not actually an injured or a party with a justiciable standing. The second one is jurisdiction, meaning that there was something about the court you chose to put this pleading into that they were or were not the correct jurisdiction. And this includes the individual that has or does not have potential certain courts that do or do not understand that they don't have jurisdiction in certain matters. And this is extremely important and very critical to pay attention to when you're considering that those that have corrected their status and now certain jurisdictional elements no longer apply. The third and final point that most of the causes for action that get dismissed on is Rule 12b-6, the failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. It's very, very important that when you're asking for relief, that you explain what you need, how you need it, and how the court can grant that relief. The issue that the court should have already known that, or you know, they should understand how this happens, et cetera, et cetera. Those are assumptions on our part. And if you break up the word assume, you take the first three letters, and then you and then me. And it makes one of both of us. Okay? When you assume that the court understands what you're seeking, or the relief should be obvious, you know, should be obvious. There's no such thing as obvious relief. Certain courts have additional to the local rules, their own rules. And there's one that I'm looking at a court from a court order from the Northern District of California, Oakland, U.S. District Court, Judge Gillum, Jr., Judge Haywood Gillum, Jr. And he has a handful of extra rules that over and above that micromanage down to the gnat's eyebrow that can, on those specific rules, you know, you can win or lose a case just on his rules. Now, having said that, to deprive somebody of their civil rights under color of law, code, practice, or policy is a federal felony, which means that the judge, being an operator underneath the people of the United States, and correct me if I'm wrong, when it comes to the Declaration of Independence, it's very, very clear that when we look at paragraph 2, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their creator, meaning that our founding fathers recognized that there was an intelligent designer or creator out there. They with certain inalienable rights, among these are the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Very, very important that we note that all those powers were, that they all come from the people, all those powers. Abraham Lincoln, when he was giving his speech on November 19th, 1863, 100 years before a man of similar character would also be in office, and they both had their challenges. That Gettysburg Address was not real wordy. It was only 272 words, but the he pointed out very clearly that as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. He's quoting the Declaration of Independence. That means that in the courtroom, even the federal rules of civil procedure and criminal procedure, as the Constitution, the Amendment 9, makes very, very clear. And for those of you who haven't recently read the Constitution, it says in the Amendment Number 9, and it's the second shortest amendment, the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall be not construed to disparage others retained by the people. The federal rules of criminal procedure, the federal rules of civil procedure, the federal rules of appellate procedure, the local rules of civil procedure for Sacramento County, the local rules of criminal procedure for Broward County, Florida. None of these usurp or override the Constitution. And according to Marbury versus Madison, any law that is repugnant to the Constitution is null and void. Marbury versus Madison, first Cranch, 1809, at line 157, it says just specifically that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void, and the rule must be discharged. That's it. So if a federal rule is depriving you of your civil rights, you cannot deem that the court understands this in advance. What Michael was stating earlier about The Rule 6B, 12-6B, or 12-B-6, excuse me, stating a claim for which relief can be granted, that includes the fact that if you believe that the federal rules of civil procedure or criminal procedure are in error, the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to have a whole lot of gowns and gavels. And when I say gown, I mean I'm referring to a jurisprudent or a justice in the feminine gender. And when I say gavel, I'm referring to a jurisprudent or a justice that's in the masculine gender. But you're going to have a whole lot of gowns and gavels that are going to first immediately say, look, I went to law school. I got 8 years or 12 years. I've got a piled high and deeper. I mean, a PhD, a doctorate in law, and that just doesn't fly. You know, these rules have been tested and tested and tested. It's been more than 100 years since the last test was made, or 200 years. Well, you know, and I actually had somebody say that it's been close to 200 years since the rule that I was pointing out has been tested. And I explained to him that the federal rules of civil procedure had they were at this juncture. I pointed out to him that they were originally updated under 28 U.S.C. 2072, and that those titles had only been in effect since November 19th, 1988. And he pointed out, well, the principle, and I asked, the Honorable Court, does the Honorable Court consider that this is repugnant to the Constitution or is null and void? Because, and I asked the question, or would, does the Honorable Court consider this as non-repugnant to the Constitution, meaning that it's in concert? And the judge gave me this horrible, funny look, and then all of a sudden he started to laugh. He says, I see your point, young man. And at the time, I was probably 10 or 12 years older than this gentleman. And he says, you realize how much hot water you're putting me in? And I says, Your Honor, he says, you're going to ask me to violate the federal rules of criminal procedure here and rule in opposite to. And I says, well, that's a good question. You know, did you want an answer? And would you like my advice on how to handle that? He says, I'm all ears, young man. And so what happened was, as I explained to him, that first of all, the rule was null and void, and that it did not require a U.S. District Court or Supreme Court or appellate court decision to make it void. It's void first, and then the second, I made him aware that, well, I asked him questions that he says, well, you know, and I went back to the Declaration of Independence. He says, well, then that means that you have decision authority over me. I says, is that the way the Honorable Court sees that, what we just reviewed? He says, well, if that's that case, if that's the way you portrayed it, I says, Your Honor, please correct me if I'm wrong, but we only read from the document itself. I made no interjection. I made no supposition or proposition. And he looked at me and he was so stunned. He says, I see your point. And I says, and at the time, his immediate overseer was Chief Justice Williams. And he says, you realize he's going to skin me alive and ask me for my tenure if I rule in your favor. And I says, well, deprivation of civil rights under color of law is a federal crime. And if he was to conspire to do that or threaten it, would that mean that that automatically voided his 28 years, 6 months, and 3 weeks of tenure, and that he's now subject to, and regardless of whether he still has tenure or is impeached, he's still subject to immediate criminal prosecution and be placed on, and should be, and if he should try to do that, if he doesn't agree and is not willing to agree, he says, then he would need to be placed under immediate arrest, wouldn't he? Or how do you read that? And this gentleman, this gavel, said I was the hardest ass that he had ever dealt with in his whole life. And I says, sir, I apologize. That's not my intent. He says, yeah, you're trying to be nice about it, but you're still the hardest ass I've ever dealt with in my whole life. And he says, the thing is, you're nice about it. He says, and I can't find any fault. Otherwise, I would find you in contempt because this is so uncomfortable, even though you're right. You know, and he's saying, even though I'm right, he says, I would find you in contempt and throw you in my bailiff's jail until I decide what to do with you. But there's all these witnesses and there. He says, and this guy's saying this from the bench with a court reporter present. The proceedings of that particular case were later sealed. But he's saying all this, and he says, so you want me to go to my boss and plead this case for you? I says, well, no. This case is before you, sir. How you handle it, whether you handle it honorably or not, is all about you, sir. There, the Chief Justice, he says, I reviewed 8 cases by name and the disposition that he ruled exactly an opposite, and that he even made an opinion that he published, and it became policy. And I've known quite a few justices that have done that. We're currently working with and fighting a justice in the Ohio area, a chief justice, no less, that a justice and a chief justice that believe in absolute unconditional judicial and prosecutorial immunity. And one of them was granted high accolade at a judicial conference in D.C. 7 years ago after he handed down that opinion, and it was later upheld at the Ninth District Court of Appeals. And of course they affirmed it. They don't want the chance of somebody pointing a finger at them and them going to jail for wrongdoing. If they're doing wrong, they don't want anybody to have a possibility of recourse. So what's happening is that at multiple levels of prosecution here, we're finding out that if the worst thing that they fear is somebody appealing it and going up the appellate level and being dismissed, they're going to continue what they're doing as long as they have breath of life. When there's a U.S. Marshal there willing to detain them against his life and his retirement, regardless, you know, of whether they're going to come back on him, then there's been very, very different rules there. They have, when they're aware of that, they become terribly, terribly conservative toward the Constitution. But what's happening is that Rule 12B, B6, or the thing is of vital importance is that when you're filing something, you need to consider what is it going to take for the judge to rule in my favor. That is the critical, very, very critical question that you must ask yourself, okay? And when it comes all the way down to Rule 12b-6, it's that short little line that has less than 12 words in it. Failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted is so huge that you have to not only, as Michael pointed out early on in my introduction, thank you very much, Michael, for that gracious introduction and the informative nature in with which you made that. The thing that's extremely critical is that the 0.0 that you make needs to be very cleanly and very succinctly and candidly stated, okay? It's very, very important
that you give them the capacity to give you a judgment. I've been in the process of rewriting one person's claim that the gentleman that wrote this thing is an unbelievable, excellent paralegal. He's got a lot of background. It's just, it's amazing what this guy knows. And he's very, very good. The only thing he did not do was state a claim for which relief could be granted. He pointed out that the bad guys were wrong, 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 wrong. Did a very good job of that. Never stated exactly what he wanted the court to do and exactly how to do it within the latitude of the jurisdiction and the authority of the court. That's very important. There's two points of latitude that you have to consider. The jurisdiction, meaning that this person, okay, is filing a claim against that person. Is that other person underneath their jurisdiction? Do they have civil or criminal authority to pursue this complaint? Or is this organization, or maybe you're pursuing the IRS, you know, does this court have the latitude and the authority to or the jurisdiction to do that, okay? Next, they have to, after jurisdiction, they have to have the authority to be able to do it. It's very, very important, and jurisdiction is part of the authority. But the thing that's very important is that certain courts are limited to what they can do. And the simplest example of that is very trite, but you can't ask a civil court to hand down a criminal indictment or a criminal punishment in their jurisdiction. While they have jurisdiction, they for that particular region, they don't have the authority that the criminal court would have. Okay, so you can't ask a criminal court for an appeal or a civil court for an appeal on certain matters. There's a you can ask them for a motion for reconsideration, which is very important, but you cannot ask them for an appeal. And a lot of individuals look at the appeal. They lose the discretion between that fine line of making a motion for reconsideration or asking for an appeal. So always ask the court for something that they have the latitude and the authority to give you relief. Very, very important. In the last 2 weeks, I've seen five cases where individuals, their complaint was turned down, one against the IRS, quote unquote, and 12B6, failure to state a claim for which relief could be granted. This gentleman lives in the Southwest, and the bad guys, the person that proceeded originally to pursue him was covering outside the lines very, very badly. This gentleman, he did not get any relief. The court, he actually did file a claim for which relief could be granted. It was kind of muddied into the water. With that, the opposing party threw everything they had at it, including lies, and belittled his very small point about the claim for which relief can be granted into something that the court accepted as genuine failure to state a claim for which relief could be granted. In the last 2 years, I've probably seen close to 60 cases that were valid complaints that people had genuinely had justiciable standing. The court had jurisdiction and the latitude to grant them the relief that they were looking for, but they failed to state the claim properly. Now, as Michael pointed out earlier, when you have evidence, you throw it all at it. But whatever you do, that little paragraph, and emphasis on the word little in all caps, that little paragraph that states the claim for which relief needs to be granted needs to be abominably candid and succinct. I've had two professors that said that that claim for which relief can be granted should never be more than five lines. He says if you're going beyond six, the chances that you're not going to get relief just jump to 50%, just like that. And one of those professors was a retired U.S. District Court judge at the time. This has been back in 1979. The second time I heard that same exact thing was in 1981. From a different professor who has also worked as a state district court judge before he retired into teaching, and pointed out that if you can state your claim in less than three lines, he said 85 to 90% of those people that state in less than three lines or less get their relief. He says you better have the information, the data, the facts to back it up, you know, and enter facts into evidence. Is extremely important. I'm going to pause for a moment to get something to drink. Supporting evidence for a claim for which relief can be granted is extremely important. Now, when you file an affidavit, that is testimony and evidence that is now entered into the record. It's sworn. Okay? Now, in the absence of conflicting evidence, they have to grant you the relief that you've asked for. If the other party is not able to use that word that was in the movie True Grit, when the Texican, told John Wayne that he would, he says, I'd muddy up your claim. I'd create a bunch of a cloud of confusion. Well, muddying up your claim is what some attorneys, that is all they are paid to do. There's some in litigation that what they do is whether it's factual or not, they raise so many questions that not just in the jurisprudence mind, but the jurors' minds, that there is. And this is especially useful for litigators in criminal cases when they want to get a defendant off, because you have to have guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they can establish a reasonable doubt by muddying up the water and creating any question, there's no way they can get a conviction. Okay? And there's a lot of judges and district attorneys and attorney generals right now that are trying to get around the fact that, they have to, beyond the shadow of a doubt. They want to say, well, let's just say it's not quite beyond the shadow of a doubt. And they try to back up, to a point with which they get the juror illegally and wrongfully to accept a delineation or a line that is not anywhere near beyond the shadow of a doubt. And so as a prosecutor, did he say that out loud? I'm certain his lips were moving. I didn't hear anything, officer. I was in the bathroom. But as the prosecutor, tries to muddy up the water, you have to figure out how to clear it up. This is the same thing in civil, in the rule 12b6. It's unbelievably important that you figure out how to unmuddy the water, and you say, Your Honor, those are all very great points that they bring up, but this is the egg yellow or is it red? That's it. No questions asked. And when it comes down to, a lot of cases like with the IRS, I know some individuals that have gone into tax court and some that have filed in civil court and U.S. District Court against the IRS, not going into tax court, but seeking relief in a different manner. Now, remember, the Internal Revenue Service is not incorporated within the meets and bounds of the continental contiguous United States. They're incorporated in Puerto Rico. There are some things that you need to remember that when you're going after these guys, that they are not incorporated in the U.S. here. So you have to file, there are certain pleadings that if you're going to go after them, you have to file in the jurisdiction in with which a bench has standing to prosecute them or prosecute your complaint, whether it's civil or criminal. Very, very important. When you're going after the IRS, some of the questions that are raised are very, very simple. Where in the United States Tax Code 26 does it point out that I am responsible for paying income tax? You know, please, I may have misunderstood something. I've been really searching as hard, but could you help me, Mr. IRS agent? I need to understand this. And would you agree that, I mean, wouldn't you agree that it's not wise to make any further payments until we do determine that I am a taxpayer? Because that means that you're going to have to pay back a whole bunch more. And would it be better if you can work this out now? This, sometimes when the case already gets to court and the prosecution has already, they file what's called a motion in limine, L-I-M-I-N-I-E, you know, motion in limine. What it means is that they're saying we don't want the jury to hear this question. Yeah, it's very, very embarrassing. They're dead wrong. It's illegal. I'm sorry, the jury is hearing the question, and but the judges are getting more and more bold, and they're breaking the rules more in the open now than rather being surreptitious. If you're going to state a claim for which relief can be granted, it has to be very simple, it has to be unemotional, and you need to do it early enough in the litigation or the proceeding that we don't have a bunch of individuals sign on with their egos so that when you ask the question, well, you know, that's a good question. And to that end, where in the IRS tax code does it say that I'm responsible for paying the income tax? It doesn't say anywhere, by the way. But there's a handful of other questions that you need to ask. But if you get it early on enough and you ask the question for which relief can be granted in the beginning, and you speak and iterate it in the precisely correct way, you may have the Treasury Department call you up or meet you at the court and say, hey, look, we'd like to talk about a possible settlement. Would you like to meet in the jury room or the witness room right now? And I may have attended one or two or maybe even more meetings where they offered a settlement, and the counteroffer was we asked them for a document on three of the four that have happened this year. We've asked them for a document that says that they're not required to file a 1040. You agree that you're not required to file a 1040. And so what's happened is that they, as reluctant as they are about it, they've asked the case to be sealed, but and I haven't had one yet. I'm still trying to figure out how to get around that. But the issue is that the couples, every one of them, have been so excited that the IRS has asked them for a concession in that they don't bother anybody else with the fact that they've gotten this court order or that they've gotten this agreement, and it is actually a court order. They've gone in, and we've asked the judge to say we're non-suiting. Here's the order. And we've demanded that they put in there that their family to posterity is not required to file a 1040. Okay. We put that in the initial pleading. It was right up to the front. Are there times when we're not successful? Yes. Are there times when we are successful? Yes. Is there any rhyme or reason to it? At this juncture, I cannot speak to that. I wish I could say I've got 100% horse feathers. Right now, those cases are that have been dispositioned that way are batting about 26 to 28%. There's about another 34-35% that we're battling on jurisdiction, and the issues that we come up with our honored friend GW, that if you have not corrected, if you had not worked with GW and got your identification in their computer corrected, I heartily and plead with you with fervence that you get that done right away. There's a lot to be had with that. It may seem like a very unsuspecting and almost unnoteworthy event to some people. Please do not underestimate the value of getting your status corrected. There's a handful of other things that collateral issues that we're dealing with right now that have come up. Winning a race is not a destination, contrary to what most people believe. The only time you win the race is after the race is over and they deemed it. But if this is a mile race and it's four laps around the 440 there, if all of a sudden you're ahead and you throw up your hands and stop and shout, "Look, I'm ahead," all the rest of the runners just passed you by. This is not a destination. This is a journey. It's like security. Security is not a destination. It's a journey. A good marriage is not a destination. It's a journey. The fact that you're winning the race means like you're running like a tortured slave with weapons held to the back of your head that are somehow keeping up with you, that you're staying just ahead of them, or something that is equally motivating to the kin of a weapon being held to your head, whether it's a knife to your throat or a 12-gauge straw. The same thing with a marriage. The fact that you have a good marriage means that not that you finally arrived and you finally got married and she's the right girl and she cooks and you come home and she does your slippers. It's the fact that you're working like a tortured slave to continue to date her every week and that you work at that marriage all the time and that you tell her you love her X amount of times a day, you know, at least once a day, and that you smile at her, and even when she screws up, or he screws up, instead of pounding it into him how bad they screwed up, use that as an opportunity to prove your love to them. And what happens is that, well, honey, you made a mistake. It's kind of bad. We got a lot of damage control with you to do here, but let's get the damage control done so that you and I can get back to having a wonderful time, you know, and use the fact that he or she just screwed up as an opportunity to prove your love and grow. With the IRS, it's the same thing. When they screw up, you can either grind their bones into it and forever have an enemy that is just waiting, crouching in the shadows to waylay you like a highwayman. Or you could say, you know what, did you guys make a mistake there? Maybe we should do this way, and then it's correct for you and it's correct for us. How about that? What do you guys think? Or did I not get that right. And when you're seeking to file a claim for which relief can be granted, I wish that I could say to you that every single time I know exactly how this time, that time, first time, every time, all the time to state the claim. I have, in my few short 40 some odd years since the first time that I attended law school, 40 some odd, it's not 50 years yet, but if there's any one thing I've learned, it's that, and that I know, is that I don't know. And the thing that punctuates this is every single time I meet a new person, their circumstances have never, ever, ever matched anybody else that I've met. The circumstances are some of them, while many of the circumstances in this individual's life may appear to be very similar to some other person's circumstances, they're not all the same. And there is no boilerplate. And the moment Michael and I have come up against a place where dealing with government entities that we've at entities that are looking for boilerplates. And we've been shocked to find out we've had calls come completely out of the blue that ends to Michael and I that says, is this one of your people? Is this somebody that you're helping? And I let the lady talk for a little bit, and then she identified that the wording was almost identical to something that I had submitted, you know, and that somebody else had submitted. And so if somebody detects that claim for relief that you're granting is not genuine and it's not in your own words, they will figure out a way to pick at it. But if the opposing party and opposing counsel realize that you're very genuine and the claim is genuine, there are times when, like the points that I mentioned with the IRS, if we state the claim properly up front, you might get shocked with a question like, would you consider a settlement out of court? And to that end, it's very, very critical that we do our due diligence before filing our motion, our cause of action. So, if you came to me, do I know all of your background? Do I know how many times you've passed this corner? How many times you looked at that and that person was sitting there with that rake and that could have fallen into traffic? And how many times it has fallen into traffic? And how many times you've actually ended up, that rake fell over and popped your tire, and, you know, the cause of action, you know, you have to ask yourself, what's your cause of action? What are you going to seek relief? You want to take the rake away from the guy? You want to have him never allowed to handle another rake? You know, you want him to be enjoined from going to that corner, et cetera, et cetera. These are just the tip of the iceberg. Only you know all of those facts. So before you come to somebody like myself or any one of the other information providers, Rule 12b-6, if you can have that mapped out, have what's going wrong, why you think it's wrong, if you know criminal or civil statutes to support your concern, and if you go look up on the internet, you know, that regarding a rake, guy standing with a rake on the corner, and has it ever been prosecuted, and has it ever gone up to appeal? You know, these things are very, very important, because if a judge looks at it, says that, well, this other court ruled on it, and you didn't know about it in advance, that could be fatal. Because what happens is that, well, the other court ruled on it this way. They've done their due diligence. I know this guy. I sat with him at a fundraiser in D.C. This judge never lets anything, so I'm just going to. But if you know about the court case in advance, and you can say, hey, there's this court case, such and such, they ruled this way, but they did not check the facts. They did not weigh the facts or the evidence, and there was no ruling regarding the other facts that were involved in it. But you explained to them, this is, they never checked the street corner. They never verified that the guy was doing this with malice, with intent, and that opinion is flawed. If you put that in your initial pleading, like Michael was pointing, the person that speaks first is usually considered to have the strength in the case. There's even references in that in religious text. But, you know, when another person speaks, you have to be prepared to rebut everything. So when an information provider is helping you establish a Rule 12b-6 standing, a claim for which relief can be granted, be prepared to do not just a little, but a lot of search and research yourself, okay? The information providers have no access to your facts. They can find out other things. They can find out cases and see if something has ever been through this court before or that before that jurisprudent, and possibly work at inoculating your case, the justice in your case, the gown of the gavel in your case, against possibly ruling in the same manner and form. I have overrun my time. At this juncture, this topic has, as is with almost all the topics that we've covered so far, on the evenings that I've had the honor and the privilege of addressing you, there's so much more there. With a 40,000 foot view, if you have an issue that we need to look at, get with Michael. I'm not the only information provider. He may have somebody that's even better than me on this topic, but there may be somebody that's better than me on that topic. But I may be the best one on this other topic over here. Michael makes those decisions on which information provider he might refer you to or pair you up with. But if you have a question, check with Michael. We're going to adjourn for Q&A. Remember, you're not constrained to the topic that was addressed that evening. Off topics are welcome. We appreciate you keeping the discussion as much as possible to the subject matter of the evening. But with that, I return you back over to Michael.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I think it could be said that a properly stated claim will address all of the English adverbs, how much, how, when, where, to what extent, to what degree. All of those questions are specified within a proper complaint. Anyways, when the opposing counsel and the IRS suggests a meeting to possibly settle out of court, John, is it fair to state something to them to the effect of, well, we're having this meeting because you've asked for it, and you've asked for it logically because you consider my position solid, and you didn't wish to try this in a court? Would it be then, if one could be fair and reasonable, would you consider being fair and reasonable then that what is today was in truth yesterday and would be tomorrow, that you would owe me the return of all the funds that you've ever taken from me, and that whatever interest that you were applying for not having it paid to you would be the interest applied to add to that amount? And then further, since this was from the beginning and is now, would you consider signing a declaration that no one in my family from this point forward, my progeny, would be required to file a 1040? Is something like that a reasonable position to take, John?
I just came to a strange observation. I've never gone into any one of those situations with the goal and the outcome of that. The goal and the outcome was always to vindicate them, just straight forward. But on the way that they act or react, I've used that to gauge what we can seek from them. And to that end, I guess you could say there are times when, yes, we could look for that. I haven't ever made that my goal. There are two people that, and one of them was elderly. She was 86 years old. They wrote her a check for $7.8 million that included interest on the money that they had of hers that they used. This was in 1983. But I think it was $7.8 million. And we got a judgment, they agreed to it. We just had the judge bless it. But they were agreeing to it in advance. We educated them on the error and the fault of what had been happening. And they didn't really, they didn't think about what having a 84-year-old widow's, oppression in the newspaper, in the Los Angeles Times or the Los Angeles Herald Examiner back then. This paper doesn't exist anymore, but they had already carried some of the Jennifer's plight, and when they thought about how it would look for their prosecution or their persecution in the media, it didn't go over well in their minds. So they were very happy to pay her. Return everything that she had paid at the time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. The routine everyone knows here is press star 2 to raise your hand. That's the asterisk underneath the number 7. Press star 2 to raise your hand. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. And it's empty inside, so just left-click inside, type away your comment or question. On the outside, there's a place to put your name and other information if you like, and then hit submit, and I'll be glad to give voice to your comment or question. The order of things of speakers to our students tonight to ask questions is beginning with Michael, then Jennifer, then Brent, then Kent. And so we'll unmute Michael first. Go ahead, buddy.
Oh, thank you. I just woke up because I've had 3 hours of sleep and 48 hours. I drove from Florida to Michigan for a job. Anyway, in light of that, I was in a dream, and I woke up. It was 9:25, and I said, I better listen in. And I have several things. But
that's
one of them, well, it's important. Anyway, one of them is Peter Graves, Frederick. Peter Graves, he writes a law course that's simple for people to understand, to study the law and how to use it. And I got my daughter Emily that course because his whole statement, the one thing that he puts forward most of the time is a judge doesn't want to read 400 pages, just the facts, ma'am, the facts, as Joe Friday would say. And they want to be able to see what you're talking about to grant the relief. And this guy is a board certified and I guess PhD attorney. I don't know, but he tells you to, he gives you the whole course. I bought the course for her to, so she could educate herself. And then on the other thing is, what John was talking about, leaving them an out. If you poke the bear has to have somewhere to go or the bear's going to run over you. And if you don't know how to handle the bear, then the bear is going to eat you. It's that simple. But the other thing, there were so many of them that just kept coming up while John was talking. Anyway, if the IRS is taking you to court over a money concern, you owe them money, and then they want to seal the case when they lose. Is not that not considered continuous
pattern and practice, RICO?
Continuous criminal conspiracy to commit a fraud, because the government's supposed to be open and transparent. And a tax case is nothing for them to seal because it's public. It concerns their point of their code, and when it doesn't align with their code, they want to seal it. But according to the Constitution, we have the right to have that protection. Is that right or not?
That is correct.
Yeah, I need to be studying that law course myself anyway. I just wanted to throw that out there for you. I'm still resting because I have to go do orientation in the morning, but I'll turn it back over to you. Thank you.
Well, before you do, did you fill out a W-8 Ben?
I've got it with me. I've got it with me.
Okay.
And I'll be educating them when I hand it to them.
All right. The other thing, too, and I strongly emphasize this, it'll be on tomorrow night's call with Mr. Slevin, is to create, you know, another way to serve the same end, and a way that is more familiar to and easily recognized by any business, is that businesses all the time deal with other LLCs. And we have people that are investing, I guess you want to call it, or acquiring Mr. Slevin's LLC that has zero tax liability associated to it because of the way it's assembled. And when you present, when you go to the potential employer, you say to him, you know, you're not hiring Michael from Las Vegas. You're hiring Michael's Crane Operations from Las Vegas, LLC. And that way, you know, you save a lot of money, Mr. Employer. You just cut a check once a month to Michael's Crane Operations of Las Vegas, LLC, and we're done with it. And they're happy to do that. They're accustomed to paying men and women to come in and clean their buildings under the LLC that they operate through, and all the rest of it. Just keep that in mind, Michael.
Well, what President said, the business of America is business, and that's what this is all about, business.
Yep. All right. Thank you, sir. Go back to sleep.
Yes, sir.
After the call.
Oh, I will.
All right. Next is Jennifer Sue. Go ahead, Jennifer Sue.
Hi, Michael and John. I just was wanting to give John a topic to discuss maybe next time he comes on, because I'd like to know more about how when you buy a house, a flesh and blood man has to buy the house, not a trust, is something that I heard for it to be a lawyer from the patent and whatever. And because my charitable religious trust bought the house and land that I live in, and will that prevent me from having a loyal title because I didn't personally purchase it. Could he speak about that sometime?
Before John talks about that in a moment, let me just throw something at you real quickly. The manager of a corporation soul is the corporation soul. The corporation soul is the manager. So there's your flesh and blood. Even though you have it through the land acquired through the corporation soul, the man still steps forward and can bring this up into Elodium. Back to you, John.
Yeah, the man or the woman.
Right.
And, Jennifer, title in Elodium is a function of tracing the title back to the original grant that gave it the authority and the privileges and rights that that were once given to it. And it's verifying, and part of that trace in Elodium is verifying that those rights weren't unnecessarily traded off or delineated. Okay? So it's of extremely prime importance that when tracing Elodium that we confirm that certain rights never went away, okay? And regardless of the individual who is occupying it, administrating it, or the individual that has, quote-unquote, purchases as an individual, or the charitable religious trust or corp soul that has purchased it, Elodium still stands in Elodium. The authority of the individual that holds the title or the entity still stands in Elodium.
Okay. All right. And there's one more question.
Michael's point was much stronger than he made it.
I kind of thought that, but then I heard a trust cannot, you know, it doesn't work with a trust, and so only a flesh and blood man. But then I thought my response was the same, that I am the corporation soul. And
Jennifer Sue. If
yes.
You look up on the internet and do a search on Elodial title or title in Elodium, they usually have that little Q&A portion there, and they'll say Elodial title does not exist in the United States because they have eminent domain. They'll say
so
that's
that.
That's
States.
On the internet. That's in the United States. And that's on.
Wow.
But see, remember, the United States was mitigated to 10 miles square.
Right.
And an eminent domain does bear in the United States. But the compact states, that's not true. So, make certain that the perspective the individual is speaking from is the correct perspective.
Right.
Also,
okay.
Trust,
yes,
99.99999% of the time are civil trusts. They're not even considering ecclesiastical trusts.
Right.
It's totally, totally foreign to their thought process.
Right. Thank you. And one more question. At some point it was mentioned that I should have my chain of title checked by Chicago Title Insurance Company. And I was wondering if you have a specific person there that you deal with. And what's the question I'm asking? I mean, what are they just checking that deed is checked or what?
Chicago, like Lawyers Title or Orange Coast Title or Old Republic Title, those are four that I deal with on a regular basis. They're all good. Any one of those. Chicago Title has a teeny bit more archived material than Lawyers Title does. So So sometimes I suggest going to Chicago Title. What I recommend is that you establish a relationship with an individual yourself.
Okay.
What you do is you say, hey, I am looking to establish clear chain of title back to the original land grant. Is this something you can help me with? And explain to them that I want to verify if there's been any encumbrances, easements, whatever, that have gone on since the original British land grant, Spanish land grant, French land grant, Belgium land grant. And yes, there are some from Belgium there. People say, well, the land grants, some people will argue that, but anybody who really knows what they're talking about will say, yes, we can do that for you. They will only probably one out of three times give you a price immediately. They'll say, I need to check on this. Give me your assessor's parcel number or your lot number, et cetera. Give me all your definitions. And then they'll look into it and they'll call you back and say, hey, look, this is what it's going to cost.
Okay. All right. Well, so I'm asking for encumbrances. And what was the other word you said? Sorry, the one word I missed.
Encumbrances and easements.
Easements. Okay. Thank you.
The proper name for that in their lingo is an abstract of title. And that follow-up question for John is that I have in the last 5 years maybe spoke to 6 or 8 different title companies where, you know, I just walked in their door and I asked them about an abstract of title, and most of them never heard of it. A couple have heard of it and just say, we don't do that anymore. So is Chicago Title doing abstracts of title?
If you go to the office on the I-10 and Katy Freeway here in the Houston area, the office manager knows exactly what you're talking about. The one that I used to deal with in Austin, that lawyer's title over there, did not know what an abstract of title was. I had to explain to him. I got to the place where, I actually, in that particular search, I went with Old Republic Title out of Sacramento, California on that search because they had done some other, I found out that they had been the title company for 8 adjacent parcels that were subdivided. It was originally a single title, single parcel that was subdivided, and it was the parcel right next to the one this one had done, and that they had asked for abstract of title. So it changes with the application and jurisdiction, Jennifer.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks again, and I'll talk to you soon, hopefully, about all of this. Anyway, I'll let you know.
Just FYI, Jennifer, I had an abstract of title done on a home that I bought in 1979. And it cost me then $600. So I would expect an abstract of title today to cost you $4,000 in that neighborhood.
Yeah, $3,000 or $4,000. If it's under $6,000 or $7,000, that would be fairly reasonable right now.
I was told it would be hours and hours and hours and hours of work, and it would cost a fortune going back to 1706. And with the mess that the whole thing is in. But anyway, we'll see.
I want to make easier money. That's all they're saying.
No, they refuse to do it. They refuse to do it even.
Yeah, John, I have another question. Can a company that does abstract of title, are they able to pull that from anywhere in the country, or must they be venue driven? Since some places
there is no venue drive for any of those. Title companies and those that are pulling up the abstracts. They're doing it from all over the U.S. They have offices, you know, all over. And lately with the, in 1987, with the advent of the KIMS system, that's a Kodak image management system, they began to share documents electronically. This is before the internet existed. And what happened is that they not only began to share documents electronically, but they began to have searchable resources at the individual title companies that you could ask them for, and they were very good at it. Then the portable document format PDF came out. And the Kodak image management system, Kodak, fell by the wayside because people were doing business, and Adobe was doing business around Kodak. So the Kodak image management system went the way of the dodo bird because the Adobe product was available. There's a lot of individuals that work in jurisdictions like here in Texas, in Austin, the government jurisdictions have all gone to the place now where they're doing PDF, portable document format. And so what's happening is that in concert with that, they to keep their budget under control and to be able to pay their salaries, what they've started to do is they sell subscriptions to access to their search. These subscriptions, like LexisNexis, are very expensive. Westlaw, very expensive. But they sell those subscriptions sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly, but usually annually to title companies. So the title company geographical location is not critical.
Right.
Well, then I would suggest if, of course, you have all this time in the world to laze about and you're not really pushed for anything, right, John? Plenty on your plate.
Right,
plenty of room.
Whatever he said, officer, that's what I always say.
Maybe you'd invite King Arthur. Young man named Arthur, to contact some of your old acquaintances to try to generate a list of title companies that would put together abstracts of title for people that are your students.
We might try to explore that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is that it, Jennifer?
I just wanted to know, is it called, like, after they've done the clear chain of title work, does that mean it's now certified by them or authenticated? Like, what would be the word they use for their work, what would that chain of title then be legally called?
Self-authenticated evidence.
They will apply and attest to it.
A test. Okay. I didn't hear the first word.
Self-authenticated evidence, they're relying upon government documents, and government documents are self-authenticating. You don't have to have a witness to support them.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Correct, John?
That's correct. And then man made God in his own image.
Right.
Of course. Or God, then man, yeah.
All right. Brent. Up for Brent, then Kent, then Anita. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening. Just a little update here. I have finally submitted my W-8-BEN today, and you will be hearing back how that goes. I spent some time writing a cover letter, and feel like it was pretty good. I'm going to be doing the same thing with the IRS thing. And Jennifer had mentioned the same thing. And I was just wondering if there's any way that if I emailed you a draft, she might be interested in reading it, passing it back and forth via, through you, Michael, so that we can get some additional input into what we're drafting.
In your introductory letter, did you also include your affidavit of status, citizenship, so that you could segue that into the thing that says, you know, this is this, so therefore that is that, and that's why I'm supplying this document, this W-8BEN to you?
I did not provide my affidavit. However, I did explain to them that I recently got my passport and I mentioned the correction, recent correction to my status, and that as a result of that, I got a new passport, and that when that passport is scanned, the IT systems recognize, or however I said it, that status change is there. I didn't want to go into a lot of detail. I didn't want to write. I didn't want to write a whole lot of detail, but basically I said the very first thing was here's there's been a correction to my status, and I talked about the passport, and then I went right into here's the W-8BEN, and please make the correction and adjust the payroll and stuff. And then at the end, I said, please call me if you have any questions. Some of the legal terms, such as, I'm sorry, I almost fell asleep. I'm really tired. Such as non-resident alien can be a bit confusing and appear to mean something other than what they mean legally. So I did mention that, and I also
fax you or text you a cup of coffee?
Yeah, exactly. I did mention that the we'll move on to the next thing.
By the way, so, I want to make a may I rudely
yes,
interrupt
please.
To make a point. He made a point. There was a point made just a little bit ago that we did not renew the passport. It's when you're changing your status, as much as possible, consider that this is a new passport and treat it that as such. Okay, unless you need to take the old passport in, unless there is a driving need. If it accidentally got lost and you weren't able to take it in, that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Do you understand? You understand the gravity of what I'm sharing? Okay, thank you. That's all you need to say. We don't go into that any deeper.
I'd like to add something too. I'm sorry, Brent. I overtalked.
No,
go ahead.
No,
I'd like to add something for Brent and for everyone else on the call. On the first strike, John and all the information providers really and truly honor and appreciate you for going to bat and creating documents that you feel express what you're wanting to accomplish. But I would encourage all of you, before you submit them, to whoever you're submitting them to, it just takes a few minutes to get them in front of John or one of the applicable information providers and just have them review it. You'd be surprised how much a comma here and a period there changes the context and makes it more amenable to your desired outcomes. So I'm just saying.
By the way, don't worry, it's much worse than you think. Michael, the documents that Michael and I have gone over just in the last couple of days, the term landmines doesn't even begin to apply. Reducing or eliminating the obvious landmines, very, very helpful.
Yep. A perfect example is someone who had corrected their status, still thinking in the old ways and comfortable with their own speech patterns, asserted that they have a residence at such and such a place. And I went, no, you don't. You're not a resident. Resident is somebody that's domiciled in Washington, D.C., but living amongst the free people of the Union States. Anyways, stuff like that. Thank you, Brent.
So, yeah, the other thing that I just wanted to bring up is that, Michael, I will be moving forward with this Slavin thing. I've realized that I need to put that at the top of the list. And part of the reason is for the LLC that Mr. Slavin does. Part of the reason is hiring somebody and having a worker. There's obviously some intricacies with that. What happens if, let's say, for instance, that there is a foreigner who's here in this country on a tourist visa, and they end up going to work for a company in New York City, and the word gets out to immigration, and before their six-month visa expires or whatever it is, they get their visa canceled because they violated the terms of their visa. Is there a way that you are familiar with that that a company such as an LLC could recruit talent from overseas and have any sway with the immigration department to get a green card issued? And would that be something that would be appropriate for one of these New Mexico LLCs? Or is it that that would be a worker and a 1099 employee, and that wouldn't really, or 1099 person, whatever the term is, 1099 worker, I guess, contractor, and so it wouldn't really apply in that situation?
You can always recruit from anywhere, and as a recruiter for your own manufacturing, the State Department encourages individuals that are offering jobs for abroad to do that recruiting. Please reiterate what you think the landmine is that you might be stepping on by the State Department, indicating that they, you know, might cancel the work visa earlier.
Well, in this particular case, it was a tourist visa, and they were working. And then, you know, is there a way for the employer to work with the State Department and have them issued a green card, a work visa?
There is absolutely a way to do that, and. You work directly with the State Department. It's an individual case-by-case basis. There isn't a straight cookie cutter on it. They approve them on an individual case-by-case basis.
Okay, and if it's an LLC, one of these New Mexico LLCs, that doesn't have employees but has 1099 workers, do you think that would make the case weaker as opposed to having, you know, a corporate employee?
I'll be very frank with you. What I know already, you're counting on that entity hiring them directly, and that's part of the agreement with the State Department. So to get them in, you know what, there may be a way around this. It just hit me. I've never been posed this question before. Um, GW may know the answer to this question. Were you on GW's call last night?
I was not.
Okay. May I humbly suggest that the next call with GW, that you go ahead and sit down with that. It's usually Monday night. Michael, were we going to do a Monday night GW call this coming week?
Are you in reference to a private call, or are you talking about Monday call?
The Monday conference call.
No, we'll be doing Monday. Saturday is Christmas Eve, so neither Bernie nor I are doing Christmas. So
so you're not celebrating the pagan satanic high feast of the penis of Ra with the golden silver testicles? I mean the actual,
no.
I mean the Christmas tree?
No.
Oh.
No, Nimrod is not allowed in my house.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah, may I humbly recommend that you suggest that to GW. While I think I have an answer for you, I'm going to withhold so that I don't risk giving you some potentially wrong information.
Okay.
I may give GW a call and table this with him. He probably has the best answer for you.
Okay. Well, I can wait for the call and do it directly with GW. No reason for you to take up your precious
okay.
time doing that.
Okay. Thank you. Next caller?
Yes. Thank you very
next
much.
Next caller. Thank you, Brent. Now Brent is following. Brent is Kent.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Kent.
Thank you. I was going to address a couple of other issues, but during the course of this questioning and your talk, there's a couple of things that I wanted to explore a little further. What I wanted to know, John, was do you see what Greg was saying last night, and I know that that was basically just overcome and Jennifer talked about it, but what Greg was basically saying is that you could never go in directly into a CRT or a corporation soul. Do you see, however, stating what you stated tonight and what Michael has stated, do you see any benefit whatsoever to first put for a lodeal title, to first put it in a man or woman's name that has a corrected status and then to later change it to a corporation soul or a CRT? Can you think of any benefit for possibly going through that procedure, or do you think that that's just unnecessary?
Okay. Now, a lodeal title is a lodeal title. Having that resolved, very, very important. Your status is a completely unique and separate and special issue. Very, very special issue. So at this juncture, for a person with their corrected status to have or a CRT or CS, to have to be the holder of the property that is in Lodium
mm-hmm.
is an extremely good thing. There are benefits that are substantially improved when that occurs. In the meantime, doing it before or after, I'm not certain that I've seen any potential landmines going one way or the other.
I do.
Okay.
I have a question, John.
Yes,
John.
Sir. Okay.
Can a slave own land in a lodium?
Well, CRT or a corp soul is not a slave. That was the question I was addressing.
The manager is the corporation's.
Yeah. Now, slaves, technically, individuals like to say that slaves can't, but for the most part, most of the litigious direction that you go, says that it can't, won't, and it doesn't identify that it's ever happened. accept it. I've become personally aware of multiple cases recently that during the mid-1800s, slaves were bequeathed substantial amounts of property and did own property before they were freed.
Really?
And it was upheld in a Virginia court.
I'd love to read that. If you'd share it with me, I'd very much like to read that.
But for the most part, the answer is obvious. No, slaves cannot, because they're the owner. They're owned by somebody else. So the owner, unless the owner is the one that bequeaths it to them, technically, no, they cannot.
Let's break this down to a scriptural level. A woman making a contract with someone upon either her husband or her father, depending on under whose roof she lives, under whose coverture she is protected, either the husband or the father can void the signed agreement daughter or the wife made.
And that's correct. In the cases that I am aware of, it was the owner that bequeathed the property to the slave. So it was under the owner's authority. And that is completely in concert with scripture on that.
Okay. That's different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's, yeah. No, it's not. Oh, okay. Now, if you're asking if a slave from this plantation can go out on their own and just purchase property from that plantation, by law, the fruits of the transaction belong to the owner of the slave. And if you're still slave to the United States of America, whether you own it, you think you own it, if you went through the trouble of going through the effort of purchasing it, it's still if it wasn't before, it is now technically property of the United States.
And proof of that is even though you paid for the land in full, no encumbrances, if you fail to pay your property taxes after 3 years, your land is
taken. They take it away from you.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. And that's something that's on the heart of our next person asking. Oh, Kent, did you have any other questions?
Oh, yeah, I have other questions, and I want to say something about that. So when you're conveying a lodeal title, ordinarily the party that presently has the property or that has some kind of interest in the property, and we talked a little about this on a prior call, not with you, John, but with others, they're probably going to be a U.S. slave and not a American national. So I hear what you're saying, and you just elaborated on what I said, but couldn't there be some issues come up with this as to who the title is coming from? I get that you're going back and researching the title, but all of those people, well, maybe not all of them way back in the beginning, but most of the people up at the present current time are going to have been slaves or are slaves. Or it's in an estate of someone who was a slave.
Yeah, I think I see the question you're asking. Are we going to have to free all this?
I don't know that I'm stating it very well, but there appears to be something deeper here
than
just saying.
Let me see if I'm going to. May I have permission to rephrase your question back to you and attempt to see if I'm actually understanding it?
Yes, you can do this. Go ahead.
Okay. If the first person it was transferred to was not a American national, does that mean that all the subsequent transfers are fruit of the poison tree?
Well, I would say yes.
Is that your question?
Yes.
To date, thankfully, that issue has not been raised any time that this has come up. What that means is that your point is extremely valid, and it could come up at any time. And the at this juncture, I have not considered that possibility, i.e., the fruit of potentially the fruit of the poisonous tree. So, I would like time to ponder and research that. Because,
well, that's why
you know you have. Yeah, because I do not have a straight pat answer for you on that, and I have not researched that. So with that, with having prefaced that with that statement, I consider that it would be no less than extremely wise if I hold any further observation until I've researched that.
Right, I can see the other side, you know, raising this issue at some point in time when they're attempting to stop you in one way or another. And I also think that by putting a property into a corporation sole or a CRT, that raises some issues rather than if it's just put into a man or woman's name, even if they're identified as American national. It looks to me like that would pass through the system easier. You know, I'm suggesting this from maybe my legal thinking isn't correct, but I'm suggesting this from a point of view of being able to get something done, you know, as expediently as possible without raising a lot of red flags. It seems to me that if you were to first put it in the man or woman's name and then later change it, I don't see how that could be a drawback to the man or woman doing that, but I could see that there could be some benefits.
Do you recall a statement that Michael made earlier about referring to a corporation soul, that the corporation soul is the man and the man is the corporation soul?
That is correct. I heard that.
Okay. Okay. Well, ask yourself this following question. What's the difference between a man and a corporation soul?
Well, there is no difference if what Michael said is true.
What Michael said is true. There's a Florida appellate court case that supports that. Michael.
Supreme Court case. It's a Supreme Court case.
Okay, I was going to say. Do you have his email address?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Can you forward that Supreme Court case to him?
I'll turn it around. All right. Would you, Brent? Sorry.
Kent.
Yeah. I'm brain infarctions. Kent, just send me an email requesting that. But it's not the Florida Supreme Court case that's so incredibly important. But it's the Montana legislature has said that the man is the corporation soul. The corporation soul is the man.
All right. Well, anyway, John, you said you want some time to think about this a little further. I respect that. So let me move on to my other comments, unless you want to add any more to that.
No, let's proceed.
Okay. So as far as title insurance companies go, is it your experience that it's best just to go back to the last title insurance company? Because, again, this was mentioned on another call when you weren't present, that one would possibly get a better deal if they used the same company, because in many cases they're not really abstracting the title anymore, researching the title. They're just simply going back to the last sale and looking at what the last title company did, and then they check up, bring it up to the present time, and they put their stamp of approval on it. So wouldn't one generally be getting a better deal? But now I ask that question, keeping in mind that the title insurance company is not saying anything to you about any hidden federal liens or anything like that, and it may be possible in the future to go back and negotiate with them and get some type of settlement for the fact that they didn't do that. So maybe in that case, it would be better to have another or other title insurance companies involved. What you're talking about these four companies that you use in general. What is your take on what I'm saying here?
You know what the difference between a title company is and an underwriter insurance company?
No, I couldn't spell it out for you.
The title companies have underwriters. I don't know any title company that considers itself self-insured. They, therefore they cannot, I don't know if you can actually call a title company a title insurance company. The title companies that I'm familiar with and I've worked with over the last however many years have all had individual insurance companies and underwriters that insure the title. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
Just FYI. So, the moment you separate and realize that the insurance portion is separated, they're pleased to go do the research you've asked them to do. It's not usually until the title, the insurance underwriter for the title company comes in and says, well, we'd like to see this or we'd like to see that. Michael and I are currently dealing with one student. It wasn't the title company, original title company, wasn't the subsequent title company, it wasn't the original insurance underwriter for that one, it wasn't the second one, it was the third insurance underwriter, and now they're on number five. But it was the third insurance underwriter that raised something about a California statute, and that's where it's become problematic. So you're going to find out that the insurance underwriters have, when they're having to write a policy, have a lot of weight and say so, and they also demand a lot more. The title company, apart from the insurance company, loves doing the research and getting the job done. You're right, they can get it done faster by going to somebody else. They usually charge you the same thing.
So when you're talking about an underwriter, does this ever get into reinsurance, or we're not talking about reinsurance at all?
And some of the properties that were transacted at title companies, the figure that I was told about 3 months ago was 86% of them are insured transactions.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that an individual who purchases a piece of property, there's a chance if it was purchased after 1961 that it probably had title insurance taken out on it. And see, that title insurance isn't just a six-month or a two-year policy. You know, anything that comes up, you know, on the title insurance that I have on the piece of property that I have, if my great-grandchildren find a problem, they can come back to the title company, and they're required to, if there's an encumbrance that they wasn't brought to their attention that was unknown, they're required to compensate for that in whatever manner possible. There was one parcel that in California that they both the city and the county did an eminent domain on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance company did not realize that a portion of the family had quietly maintained title in allodium the whole time. And when individuals purchased, actually leased some of the property from the county, they all of a sudden were struck when these people showed up on their property with dozers. It was pointed out that, excuse me, this is our property. No. It was eminent domain. There's the judge's court order. Excuse me, this is part of an original Spanish land grant. The judge has no authority. We are the highest. No. This is America. This is eminent domain. No, excuse me. The Enablement Act for the state of California supports all the original land grants. This is one of them. Needless to say, that county, I think last year, to the living 19 descendants, paid $28 million in lease and rent for that property. Rather, you know, and it was $217 million in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the email. And, but that was something that the state of California, is belling up to the bar on a whole bunch of stuff because they said, oh, the eminent domain. And they were totally, they ran in completely oblivious. And the governor back then, he almost had a recall election. And Jerry was very scared and encouraged the state's attorneys to negotiate with the family to get it resolved. Finally.
Mm-hmm.
But, title in Elodium is still title in Elodium.
So let me clear this point up. So if one had a piece of property and they sold that property conventionally in the system, no American nationals, Federal Reserve notes, et cetera, and they just sold the property, and then 5 years later, whatever the time period is, somebody found the party who purchased the property goes to sell it, and some issue comes up about the title. So what you're saying is the title insurance goes on in perpetuity, and if that party then said, well, wait a minute, you sold me a piece of property, and even though I went out and got my own title insurance, there was a defect prior to that, so they turn around and they include you as the seller or your corporation, LLC, trust, et cetera, in the lawsuit, would you then have a cross-claim against the title insurance company?
On this particular one, now, what the judge in this court will do versus the one next door or
mm-hmm.
the one two doors down is very different. Can be extremely different. And
mm-hmm.
rarely ever is it identical. But in that particular case, the title company covered a whole bunch of costs for one individual that had been sold up that this parcel had been subdivided.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let me, I thank you for that response. Let me move on to the other thing that I wanted to address that was said previously. Michael was saying when the question and answer portion started at 10 o'clock that he liked the idea, if the IRS is conceding, basically, he liked the idea of, and you didn't necessarily jump on that bandwagon, but the idea of, okay, you go to them and you give them a list of things you want. Now, I kind of look at the IRS, and I'm interested in your opinion on this. I kind of look at the IRS as a business operation, and in business, if I had someone that had to concede because of other state statutes, you know, it was after the fact, or they were going to concede because they didn't want this thing in the open and they might have 100 other claimants come along. I find it better to let them tell me what they're going to do for me rather than me giving them a list of what I want them to do. And, you know, I can agree to stay the case or whatever, if it's a case, whatever, you know, and negotiate this. And do you see that as viable with something that most people consider a government entity, even though it really isn't? Or do you like the approach of going in there, to a certain extent at least, and telling them, okay, well, you're conceding, so now this is what I want? I think you can get more by letting them tell you what they'll give you and then squeezing some more out of them as they tip their hand in what they're doing. Am I correct, or is my approach, do you think, off with an entity like the IRS?
I've, in my minuscule interactivity with the IRS and I'll preface it with that statement.
Mm-hmm.
There, I have found that good communication goes a long way. And I've never been to the situation where there was either I'm letting them talk or I'm talking. Whether they're talking or the student is talking. I've never, you know, or making, they're making the demands or the student's making the demands. I've never been in a situation where it's all been one or the other, like they're describing. It's always been a, the best thing that I like to do is have active communication, know what their expectations and what they want out of it, out of everything is, and work with them at meeting those and let them know where that may or may not work and where it may fall through. And by working with the IRS and explaining those things so that there's no hidden, they realize that you're being completely transparent. Many of them become completely transparent as well. And they will keep you abreast so that it's not a the term I like to use for that is positional negotiation. There's multiple types of ways to negotiate. One of them is they're offering a for sale this tin can for a dime, and you walk in and say, "Well, I want to pay you a nickel for it." And they say, "Well, I can't go to a nickel, but I'll go to 8 cents. Well, I'll go to 6 cents, you know, and all of a sudden you end up agreeing at 7 cents to pay, to buy the tin can."
Mm-hmm.
That's positional bargaining. Then there's positional negotiation. Then there's negotiation on the merits. You know, that's a really neat tin can, but if you can show me it's worth a dime, I'll pay your dime right now because the tin can is dented. And it's already opened. It doesn't have pressure. And it's got some corrosion that limits my use for it. Now, can you tell me? And sometimes, now this is where your thought comes in. You could ask them, well, why do you feel it's worth a dime? And ask them first. And then say, well, you know, that those are all good points. And right now, because it's got corrosion over here, there's a dent on that side. The lid was not cut cleanly. And I'm going to have to do some work before I can do anything to use this tin can, this old tomato can. The amount of work I'm going to have to put into it to make it worth a dime, because, you know, Brand X is over there selling it for 11 cents with all these, without any of these defects. I might have to put 5 or 6 cents worth into it to make it market comparably acceptable product. I think I can only afford to pay 5 cents for it. Can you work with an offer of 5 cents, knowing what I've shared with you now? And that's called negotiating on the merits. When you work with the IRS, you always negotiate on the merits. Positional negotiation eventually gets everybody in trouble. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I didn't want to leave you. Let me clarify something. I didn't want to leave you with the impression that I had them over a barrel, whatever the case be, a business or the IRS, and therefore I didn't need any communication. You always need communication to move things forward. It just depends on how you're going to do it and what you're going to let the other party say and find out what they're willing to give you. That's what I was trying to get to that point.
I'm not supposed to tell you that everyone in my office, in this office, calls the IRS agents, load on slime, he's come sucking bottom feeder, so I'm not going to tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I had a couple of other things, but they don't pertain to anything that was said on this call directly, so I don't want to take all the time. There's probably other people who want to ask questions. So thank you for your comments, and thank you for answering. I appreciate it.
All right. I have a follow-up on what Kent has said, and that is he made the comment that the IRS was not a legitimate government entity. I want to point out that with the Corporation Act of 1870, which allowed for the Act of 1871, where the Congress, without authority from the Constitution, i.e. from we the people, created basically a new government operating within this 10 miles within the seat of power. They have an internal revenue service that is internal to that venue. The national revenue service, if you would, which is the Constitution, I'm playing with words here, is taxes are apportioned, they're imposed, they're tariffs, or they're excised. That's the four categories of tax that is national. I just am saying that internal revenue operates legitimately and lawfully internally. The problem is that they extend their borders by great assertions and assumptions and presumptions.
Do they operate? You say they operate lawfully. Wouldn't it be more correct to say they operate legally? I don't see how they're operating lawfully. I mean,
correct.
This kind of
goes. I stand corrected. Thank you.
All right. Okay. I stand corrected also. Thank you very much for pointing that up.
All right. Anita, you've been most patient.
Yes. So it would seem. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
So I have two parts, I think, to this question. Well, Jennifer and I have both done similar research on our allodial titles spanning 2.5 years. And so my question is, should we have just forgotten that and gone directly to one of these title companies and had them do the research and saved us all that sweat, equity, and time and everything? That's part one. And then also, since we have done the research, would that give us a leg up on as far as what they have to do is just verifying a lot of our digging that we already did? And anyway, then I might have one more question. So
I agree
there
with
you go.
Matter.
The answer
I've
to
unmuted,
both your questions.
I've unmuted you, Jennifer.
Jennifer, the answer to both of your questions is yes. There is value in going to the title company, and yes, the work that you did in advance is all very constructive. You can actually go to a title company, and if you are able to walk in the front door, then you don't have to package it up in a complete electronic document and send it to them. But if you can walk in the front door, because remember, your research is probably valuable to them. If you send them an email with all the research you've done, you know what they're going to do with it. They're going to put it in their archives and use it to make money off of, you know. But if you walk in and say, look, I've got all this research. I have this gap here. I have this gap here. And I want to confirm the original tie here. And can you look into filling these gaps for me? And the gap from this one, from this date, from that person, to through an unknown individual to this person. And then I've got these other two gaps over here. So what happens is you're using them to fill in your gaps. They're not doing the complete research all from scratch themselves. I did take two people with a title company that was Lawyers Title years ago when they had offices here in Houston, which they no longer have. Both of these individuals not only retired, but they've now passed away. But for the research that I was doing back in the 90s and the early 2000s on about 80 parcels, we got to the place where one hand washed the other, and I hadn't paid them for their services. Let me rephrase that. They had not sent me a bill in 2.5 years for probably close to 1,100 hours worth of work, and I was keeping track of it. And I was wondering when the penny was going to drop that they were going to bill me. And and I was keeping an account almost like an escrow account. I had set up a separate bank account where I was keeping those nickels for the hours and time that they were spending, all in abeyance and under escrow for them. What happened was is that we had such a developed such a good relationship. They said, "Look, John," and the vice president, who was a lady, and her husband also worked at the main office for Lawyer's Title. They had made the comment that says, "Look, you've been such a benefit to us, you know, and right now, you know, you said you thought you owed us this amount, or you asked us if we what we owed you for that. Says we're going to wash that as clean, and if you if you're okay with that, we've been trading work, and you gave us permission to use some of your work years ago, and we've been making money on that, and they were very honorable, and I never paid Lawyer's Title till they left the Houston area in 2011. I never was asked by Shelley to pay another cent. There are some things that you can do with." Shelley was absolutely enamored and fascinated with the searches on the little title that I was doing. It was something she had never learned, and I didn't have a clue. I was, you know, "Wow, what's that, John?" You know, I mean, it was literally that crazy, that wild and that fascinating for her. And so what happened was that I was teaching her, and we traded, and she was having her attorneys and their accountants and their agents do unbelievable amounts of work for me that she never charged me a cent for. Initially, the first 5 or 6 months that I was working with them, I think I paid her like 22 or almost 20, well, actually, no, including the initial deposit, it was 26,000. But, that was for like 5 or 6 months worth of work that I was getting from her. The work that you're gonna get, you're going to have them fill in the blanks. And then if we can look at that and say the blanks are filled in, that's good. I learned one thing, Anita, that attorneys and such like that work for the title companies, if they sniff blood in the water, I mean, somebody tracing a title into a lodium, it's like, they are entrepreneurs. They want to earn money and they make money any way they can, you know. And, if they find out that, you know, that while there's whole work is going on and it's going for a lodium, and Shelley had three of her attorneys terminated and prosecuted without me lifting a finger for them trying to arrange for sales of other properties that were within the same land grant that they were trying to purchase themselves so that they could, for purely selfish interest. I would say don't give away all the cookies. You know, you give a mouse a cookie, he'll want a drink of water. You give an attorney something that may have value, he's going to try to figure out how to make money off of it. I may have one of these obnoxious little pieces of sheepskin somewhere on some wall that survived a fire that we had 8 years ago that makes a rumorous allegation that I have some kind of Institute of Academia's recognition of my studies in jurisprudence and given me a bachelor's degree in it. Okay, that's, and you notice how carefully I put that. Did any of that qualify or make me uniquely qualified or endow me with any wisdom or wit on how to deal with what I had learned? Not. It gave me a background that was nothing more than just a license to learn. By the way, I never invested in the bar. But you all the work that you've done, fabulous. I applaud both of you. You two are some of the sweetest, most precious people in my life right now. If I had to take a number of 25 and number the sweet and precious people in my life, both you, Anita and Jennifer, would be among that 25. And that's based on your character, the way you work, the way you approach, the temerity of your character, and the ethics that you hold, okay? And respectfully, the way you treat each other and everyone that I've heard you work with. To that end, I would hate to see you hurt and mistreated by somebody that you didn't have to be. Don't give the whole job to Lawyer's Title or Chicago Title or any one of the others, or, you know, Mill Title, or, you know, Heritage Title, or Old Republic Title, or Orange Coast Title. Don't give it all to them. Give them a specific little task to fill in the blank. Say, hey, I'm just doing some research. I'm a historian. I'm doing some historical research on my property or this property. I'd like to hire you to fill in that blank. Your sole and exclusive objective is to fill in that blank. Nothing else right now. If you think there's something else that might be helpful, bring it to my attention. And it might be my honor and privilege to negotiate something into our agreement and give you some fees for that. Thank you. And that's the way you handle it, okay?
Okay. Okay, then that's very good. Thank you for what you said about us. That's very nice. Nice to hear. So my second question is,
by the way,
as a student,
that's,
go ahead.
By the way, Anita, that's just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
Dragnet. There we go. I heard about Dragnet from my grandmother. I never.
Hey,
okay.
Hey, look, lady, we'd love to help you out. Which way do you come in? Yeah, right.
Okay, so, sorry. My next question, going along with this, as a student and going to court, I assume, eventually, or if I'm lucky enough, I don't go to court, but I don't know how that works. But that's not my question. My question is, as a student, say I'm in court, must I personally know all the previous rulings having to do with allodial titles, property taxes, and foreclosures, say, in my state or in the U.S.? Do I have to have that written down somewhere so I can refer to it? And where do I find that? Or am I going to be helped with knowing those facts? Because I don't know anything about looking. Yeah.
Michael,
did
John,
you have
if you engage the team to pursue mm-hmm. that aspect of the actual lawsuit and things like that, then you're going to have all of your teaching syllabus that is required to have a outcome that you desire to have in that litigation.
So, in other words, things to quote what judgments were previously ruled upon. Is that what
all that? Yeah, that's called shepherdizing. It's called shepherdizing the case.
Okay,
John, correct me.
That's correct. Hang on just a moment here. I'm going to put you on hold for a second. Hang on. I'll be right back.
Michael?
I'm here.
while we're waiting, how do we get
okay, thank you. I just, my humble apologies. I got the background noise taken care of. I had an air conditioner or air handler start up, and I was almost couldn't hear you guys. And I, my humble apologies. But thank you. I'm back. Okay, go ahead, Anita.
Oh, well, Michael was saying that I would be given a packet of information or whatever he called it, shepherdizing the case with all the previous from my team, with all the previous rulings that I wouldn't, I assume I don't have to search and do some legal search through the entire United States for what's been decided before, according to Elodio claims. That's what
right.
I understand Michael said.
Michael has access to, and I'm not just going to speak for myself on this moment, Michael has access to a lot of information resources. The list is very voluminous that of individuals that he has access to. Depending on what your specific needs and requirements are, I think Michael was considering that if you engage the team, he will, at his discretion, provide individuals on each of the subject matter material that are the best that we have to offer to assist you.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, with that, it's our honor and privilege to be whatever asset or blessing we can. I wish that I could say that I was absolutely the top shelf on everything. Horse feathers. If there's anything I've learned, girl, if there's anything I know, is that I don't know. It's my honor and privilege to share and give you what I have, and I will try to never become arrogant enough to say that I am the end-all. I know what's happening here. This is what the final is. There's always more to learn. In the meantime, we'll give you the best that we have to offer.
Okay. Very good. I think Jennifer had something.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Anita. John, thank you for praising
me. Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
I praise you, too. Now, if I don't give all the whole chain of title to the Chicago title company, how can they attest that that whole chain is self-authenticating? If I don't, or could I say, I'll give you all of this information, but do I get a cut in the price or something like that? Or
now, if that's the product you're asking for, that they give you that they a certification so that you, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, the place you're going with that is that you want a statement that has legal standing that qualifies as testimony and evidence that you can enter into the record in a dispute
right.
with
yes.
the local jurisdiction to be able to say, you said this, I've got this expert witness right here that has this information and they've attested to it, and here is the testimony and evidence that I have already entered into the record. Now, you're saying differently, or you're saying that I have no standing to do so, but this testimony and evidence is in controversy to your statement. Would you like to present some evidence to support your statement? Or do you have something that contravenes what I just presented? And that's the way you handle it. And when they don't, you know, and you smile at them and you say, you know what? You may not feel comfortable with making a statement on this, and I'm going to tell you something. I've spent 6 months or 6 years of my life working on this. And I'd like to say to you, I've worked with some of the best experts in the field. And there's always a question. So if you feel like there's a question, I'd like for you to raise it. But if at this time you do not have any legitimate objection with testimony and evidence that you're prepared to enter into the record, I would like you to enter with me in a joint motion that the court honor my request to cease and desist on any further taxation until such time as you do come up with something.
Okay. But my question was more, that's good to know, but my question was also the actual title company that you said, well, they will take the information we give them and make money on it. The
law. Oh, they're going to. You know what? Everything you give them, title companies, everything, all of it is, that's their life making money, Jennifer. That's
right,
all there is to it.
But I thought
you know what?
They'd get them all the information, but
Okay, you know what? I should have completed where I was going with that.
Okay.
I should have stated the relief for which way I was seeking on that when I filed that claim, that motion there. The relief, the point where the penny drops is when you speak with these people, ask, you know, and be open to asking, and I didn't finish this, open to ask them, hey, you know, if I can provide you with a whole bunch of information on the research that I've already done, could we not only give me a discount for the work you don't have to do to get this, but as you're probably going to enter it all into your records and make some money off it, could you give me an additional 10% or 20% off? You know,
okay.
Use it to, that's where I was going with that. Use it as a negotiating point to help keep your nickels in your own pocket.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Now, would you give them all of the book library and book number and the page numbers? Or just the
oh yes, just... give it all to them. Yep.
Okay.
So that
yep.
they have all the facts, ma'am. The facts and nothing
yep.
but the facts, ma'am.
Okie doke. All right. Well, that's
okay.
all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
All right.
Can I
yep.
say
awesome.
One thing? Sorry, am I still on? So is
yeah.
there are two contradictory statements. One, don't give them everything, and one, give them everything. So I'm still
okay.
confused.
Okay, Anita. don't give them everything without negotiating. I got rabbit trail
okay.
here.
Okay,
don't give them everything
it.
Without negotiating for it. Yep. It's
okay.
Because eventually, let's face it, to get what you need and want, you're going to need them fully on board. But negotiate
mm-hmm.
with it. Okay? Don't give it for free.
Okay.
You know,
okay,
right. see if they're willing to negotiate with it, you know, and if they say, look, you know, there's nothing we can do about that, okay, it didn't hurt to try, okay?
Okay, I get it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for some great questions tonight. We blew the doors about an hour ago past what we were supposed to do, at least with my agreement with John. So I want to thank you for your great questions tonight. I want to thank John for staying here longer than what he was supposed to and for, you know, being here tonight and sharing with us this incredible information. I want to remind everyone to be here on the call tomorrow night when Mr. Slevin will again go through the process of how and why this specific LLC that he has does not generate a tax liability. And it's very important that you understand this and actually that you proceed through it and do it for yourself, whether you are an employee presently or you're an entrepreneur or you are a major corporation like, you know, what Lee Iacocca had. What was that? Chrysler. I think Chrysler or one of the big car companies out there converted to becoming an LLC. It's because it's awesome. So until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.